My name is Edgar Mannheimer, and this is Kalam, a podcast about the Middle East.
If to be frank with you, if not the Holocaust, it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
So in the 20s, you couldn't foresee a wave of millions coming, millions Jews coming to here, because without the Holocaust, all this doesn't happen.
Yeah.
My father would have never come here. Never.
That was today's guest, Gideon Levy. And we're going to return to Gideon in just a second. But first, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Edgar Mannheimer, and I've been a radio journalist for the past 10 years. And this is Kalam, a podcast by myself and my brilliant team of researchers and producers. Kalam is Arabic for talk or discussion. Simply put, I want to talk to interesting people about the culture, history, and politics of the Arab world and the Middle East more broadly. And at this point, you may be wondering, why me? I'm from Sweden, but I grew up in Egypt and Jordan, and I speak fluent Arabic. I went to high school in the Jordanian capital, Amman, and because the majority of Jordan's population are Palestinians displaced during 1948, all my closest childhood friends are Palestinian. And I consider it an honor to know that at least some of them are listening right now. I spent several years as an adult living in Cairo, working as a freelance journalist. The connections, both personal and professional, I've made over the years have provided me with an invaluable well of insight and love. And while I usually cringe at the overuse of identity politics, it would be silly of me not to mention the fact that my family name, Mannheimer, is a Jewish one. My upbringing was steeped in Jewish culture, and I have a large extended Jewish family in Sweden. The combination of my Jewish family background and the Arab culture I grew up within has allowed me to truly embrace different and often contradictory perspectives. It's because of this that I think I'm uniquely suited to host this podcast, and I say that with all humility. There's no coincidence that I chose to launch this podcast in the middle of one of the bloodiest catastrophes the Middle East has seen in decades. Israel's war in Gaza, following the October 7 attack, has now claimed over 30,000 Palestinian lives, nearly half of them children. I think understanding the Middle East has never been more important, and it's why I've dedicated the first series of the podcast to exploring the history of Palestine. I hope this podcast turns out to be a source of knowledge and understanding, and if you haven't stopped listening yet, I thank you. Now, on to the show.
Je suis à la fois ahuri, bien lié par le fait que ceux qui représentent les descendants d'un peuple qui a été persécuté pendant des siècles.
I'm both astonished and outraged by the fact that those who represent the descendants of a people who were persecuted for centuries for religious or racial reasons, that the descendants of these people who are today the decision makers of the State of Israel, that they could not only colonize an entire people, partly drive them out of their land and seek to expel them for good, but also, after the massacre of October 7, engage in a real massive slaughter on the populations of Gaza and continue incessantly hitting civilians, women and children. And to see the silence of the world, the silence of the United States, protectors of Israel, the silence of many Arab states, the silence of the European states who claim to be the defenders of culture, humanity, human rights. I think we're living through a horrible tragedy, because we're also powerless in the face of this thing that is unleashing. At least, I say, bear witness. The only thing that remains if we cannot resist concretely is to testify. Let's resist in our minds. Let's not be fooled. Let's not forget. Let's have the courage to face things head on. These are the words of the 102-year-old French-Jewish philosopher and my namesake, Edgar Morin. He's old enough to have fought in the French resistance against Nazi Germany and is one of France's most revered intellectual figures today. It's fascinating to me that anyone would be so lucid in their thinking at the tender age of 102, not to mention so courageous in their steadfast insistence on calling out the crimes committed in the name of his religion. It also strikes me as rather stupefying that this 102-year-old is more coherent on current affairs than the President of the United States. I think this is important, because what 102-year-old Edgar Morin, a Jew himself, says here would probably be considered anti-Semitic in Germany today, not to mention Israel. Take Yuval Abraham, for example, an Israeli Jew who recently received the award for Best Documentary at the Berlin Biennale, together with his Palestinian filmmaking partner, Basil Edra. While accepting the award on stage in Berlin, Yuval decided to say something.
In 2 days, we will go back to a land where we are not equal. I am living under a civilian law, and Basel is under military law. We live 30 minutes from one another, but I have voting rights, and Basel is not having voting rights. I am free to move where I want in this land. Basel is, like millions of Palestinians, locked in the occupied West Bank. This situation of apartheid between us, this inequality, it has to end.
Since then, Yuval has received death threats in Israel and had to postpone his return to the country. The mayor of Berlin, who is not Jewish, called the incident anti-Semitic. I struggle to understand the gall with which the non-Jewish descendants of the Nazis accuse living Jews of anti-Semitism if they dare to criticize Israel. Well, in this proud vein, I'd like to present to you another famously anti-Semitic Israeli Jew, Gideon Levy. On the previous episode of the Kalam podcast, we looked at the Nakba, the catastrophe that befell the Palestinian people in 1948 when the State of Israel was declared on the 14th of May of that year. The 14th of May is an arbitrary date for most Palestinians, as the ethnic cleansing of Palestine began long before that date and is arguably still going on. But for Israelis, the 14th of May is Independence Day. And considering our last episode and the many horrors that took place, it's almost hard to conceive that this would be celebrated by anyone. But for most Israelis, this is the day when the brave Israeli Defense Force fought back hordes of rabid anti-Semitic Arabs and created a safe haven for Jews across the globe. How is it that Israelis have come to believe this, and to what extent is Israel a safe place for Jews today? With us today to help us understand these phenomena is the renowned Israeli journalist and political dissident Gideon Levy. Through his weekly column in the center-left newspaper Haaretz, Gideon Levy provides an invaluable counterpoint to the far-right pivot that Israel has made in the past few years. Gideon, thank you for your important work and welcome to the Kalam podcast.
Thank you, Edgar. I'm happy to be with you here.
Gideon, I'd like to begin by quoting one of your columns from April of last year entitled, "There is no Israeli Independence Day without the Palestinian Nakba." You write like this: "Israel celebrates its founding and independence knowing it's doing so on the back, life, property, liberty, land, and dignity of another nation. It's doubtful there are many other national holidays celebrated for the disaster of another nation while trampling on every display of its self-expression. All this is even worse since most victims of the other nation's national disaster and their offspring, that national disaster that Israel celebrates with jubilation and exultation, live under Israeli rule. Yes, this is their day of disaster, which never ends, an awful, appalling disaster, a small Holocaust." Gideon, what do you mean by this?
You see, we Israelis, look only upon ourselves. We don't see anything around us. We didn't see it before 48, and we don't see it after 48. And that's attitude. This is the basic of the Israeli attitude toward the Palestinians, toward the Middle East. It starts with the famous notion that the people without land arrive to a land without people. And we really didn't see the other people, or we didn't want to see them there. But Palestine was a vivid place where hundreds of thousands of people lived for generations. We didn't see it. We didn't see when we conquered Palestine and went to this war that we call it the independence war, and they call it the Nakba, rightly so, we didn't see the price they paid. I remember as a child in Tel Aviv going, passing by ruins all over Israel, never asking myself, who lived here? Where is he now? What happened to him? How come the Jewish families are living in his home? How come that he didn't come back to take back his property? And it took me years and years to get answers to those questions, because in Israel, nobody, at least in the 50s and the 60s, when the state was very young and very fragile, nobody would dare to raise those questions. But now when Israel is a regional empire, regional superpower, I think that those questions should be raised and should be answered. And yes, when we are celebrating Yom HaAtzmaut, this is the Independence Day of Israel, which is supposed to be the happiest day of Israel. I remember as a child, this was the one day in which my parents allowed me to come back as late as I wish, at night, no limits. This was the day of celebration, but this is a day of a terrible national tragedy which happened to our neighbors, to our fellow Israelis, because part of them are really living with us physically. And not to at least recognize it, realize it, recognize the fact that this is their day of sorrow, that's arrogance in a way that I cannot accept.
Yeah, you mentioned your transformation, which I want to get back to later because I find it very interesting and many people have gone through that kind of transformation. But if we stick to the sort of mainstream Israeli narrative, what exactly are Israelis celebrating on their Independence Day?
For most of the Israelis, this is the day that the state was established. For most of the Israelis, this is the safe place, the refuge place, the rescue place for the Jewish people, the center of the Jewish life in the world, the first independent Jewish state, and the Jewish democratic state. None of this is true, by the way. While celebrating, we are doing it not only on the account of another people, but these people suffer never stopped ever since 48. And this is so crucial to understand. It's not like they sacrificed certain things in 48. And, you know, history is going on and they should now enjoy what they have. No, what happened in 48 never stopped ever since then. The same policy, the same principles, the same oppression, nothing changed.
You mentioned in your previous answer that you went through a transformation, that you yourself as a young man were allowed by your parents to stay out late on Independence Day. And for many years, I'm sure you also bought into the mainstream Israeli narrative. Can you describe what this transformation was like? When I speak to other Israelis who went through the same thing and other Jews around the world, they describe it almost like a spiritual awakening, because I guess it's so difficult to break out of the majority opinion in a country this is the national myth. So describe how that came to be.
So here I will disappoint you, because it was not that one day I saw the light or the darkness. It is a long, long process. So there is no dramatic moment in which, wow, it happened. No. In my case, at least, it's a long process, which, by the way, continues until this very day. Because I went through more than one shift. It was first to realize the Nakba, to recognize it, to know about it, to understand the meaning of it. It was then to realize and recognize the cruciality of the occupation. It was then moving from supporting the two-state solution into supporting the one-state solution. So things are happening, and I follow them with a lot of curiosity and really a will, openness to change my views, to change my perceptions. It's even not views, it's perceptions. But getting back to the beginning, I can't even remember when did it start. When did I start to understand what's going on around me? I was a typical product of the Zionist brainwash system. I grew up, by the way, not in a very political home, not a very political family, mainly for sure not radical leftist, center left, but very much not political. You must understand that our parents, I say our because it's a generation question, they were all refugees from Europe who tried to build their life from the beginning. My father separated from his parents and his fiancée in the railway station of Prague. He had a PhD in law. He never saw them again, neither his fiancée nor his parents. He was half a year on a boat in the Mediterranean without having the possibility to embark any place. Finally, they were detained in Beirut, Lebanon. And then he came to this country, which he felt totally as a foreigner here, as a stranger. He never adjusted. He remained a refugee to the end of his life. He was European by all criteria. And this Levant was not the right place for him. And he really suffered. From living here. On the other hand, he had his life. It's not a tragic story because finally he had family and his life was decent. But those people were not very political. I mean, at least in this case, they were survivors, surviving. They were struggling for their survival and building some new private life, which is not very easy. He was 26 when he came here. So it's already an age that it's harder to change. Not there like he came here as a child. So for me, it was to wake up. I remember at the age of 14, I was 14 in 67. And my parents and I and my brother, we went with our private little car to the first tour in the West Bank. It was very, very exciting. We went to Hebron, to Nablus, to the holy places, to the Wailing Wall. Wow. You know what I don't remember at all from this tour? I don't remember seeing one Palestinian.
Wow.
I remember the white flags and sheets on the terraces. Everywhere there were white sheets. It was a few weeks after the war. I don't remember I saw one. I'm sure I saw because they were there. I have no memory of seeing them at all.
Wow.
I just remember the places without the people. So a very efficient brainwash system at home, but mainly the education system and the media is really putting inside you those seeds of blindness.
Yeah.
And you grow up with this blindness, and then to break it, you really need the open mind to do it, because most of the Israelis don't have this open mind all of a sudden to change the whole perception. The whole perception. It's not, you know, changing your view if there is climate change or not climate change, and do you fight against it or not. That's your whole existence, your whole identity changes.
Yeah. It sounds like the movie The Matrix or something, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was not imposed. It's not that someone played in my brain. It was just open my eyes.
Yeah. If we return to the Nakba itself, can you try to get inside the mind of someone like David Ben-Gurion, who I guess was of your father's or maybe even your grandfather's generation, David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, who, according to many Israeli and Palestinian historians, actively orchestrated the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in the late 40s. Why did he do it? Or rather, how could he believe it to be justified at the time?
If, to be frank with you, if not the Holocaust, it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
So in the 20s, you couldn't foresee a wave of millions coming, millions Jews coming to here, because without the Holocaust, all this doesn't happen.
Yeah.
My father would have never come here. Never. He would live his life in Europe and would never think about it.
Yeah.
Don't forget that Jews didn't come here for 2,000 years, even in times they could come here. Yeah, there was the rhetoric and the prayers, and but nobody came here. There were very, very few Jews who lived here.
Yeah.
So it's not like all those pathetic descriptions of Zionism that the Jews were waiting 2,000 years to come here. No, they didn't come here. They could have come in many parts of history and they didn't do it.
Yeah.
They came only when they had no other choice.
Do you think your father, sorry to interrupt you, but a thought just occurred to me. Do you think that your father, had he been given the choice, would have preferred to escape or flee to another European country or a Western country rather than the Levant?
Look, my father would never agree to everything I say here because he convinced himself this, that he is very happy in Israel and that's his place. He never complained about anything.
Hmm.
This is my view when I'm an older man, when I look at him. It was not his way of thinking. He would say that he was very happy here. When I look at him now with perspective, I understand that he didn't find his place here. I mean, he would have been much happier in Europe. It's even small thing. He was German and he couldn't understand certain things here. I mean, he couldn't understand how can someone dare to call or to come between 2 and 4 in the afternoon, because this is the Schlafstunde. How can someone do it at all? He couldn't understand the concept of having an overdraft in the bank, which is in Israel the most common thing. Everyone has overdraft in his account in the bank.
What does that mean?
My father couldn't overdraft when you pull more money than you have.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
In your account. We call it overdraft.
Yeah, like a credit system.
Yeah, but this is even before the credit cards. It's, you know, you have 10,000 shekels in your bank and you spend 12,000 shekels.
Hmm.
Very normal here. So I don't think he really fit here. But he was a happy person. So I will do injustice to him by portraying him as someone who was very miserable here, who was longing to Europe. He didn't want to go to Europe even for visits.
Yeah.
Which shows the way that he didn't want to confront what he missed and what he lost. He never went to his village where he was born. It's not a village, it's a town. It was in Sudetendeutschland, in the Sudets, because nobody remained there. The Germans were expelled from there, the Jews were expelled from there. It's now nothing to do with his, but he never went to see his house, nothing. He didn't want to confront it at all.
Yeah.
And coming back to Ben-Gurion, Ben-Gurion understood much before the others, I'll say it in a very tough way, it's either us or them.
Yeah.
The consequences are very clear. If it's either us or them, so it will be us and only us. Even if you look at the map of Israel, there were certain areas which were ethnically cleansed, and there were some others which were not, like the north part of Israel. And it quite depends on the generals who were there, because Ben-Gurion was, with an historical understanding and perspective, he didn't want to be remembered as the one who committed ethnic cleansing. So he quite left it to the general's initiatives. He gave them the idea, he gave them the impression that they should do it, but he never, you can't find really evidences of orders to expel all the Palestinians from certain areas, even though between Tel Aviv and Gaza, all the south part of Israel was totally cleansed. There's not one single Palestinian village between Tel Aviv and Gaza, along the beach, along the coast. So he, I think, understood that it's either them or us, and we should do anything possible to minimize their number. And that's, by the way, again, a principle which accompanies Zionism until this very day.
And I guess what one tries to understand is how he reached that conclusion. Because it seems that he somehow, and people of his generation, had reached that conclusion before the Holocaust, before the Nazi takeover of Germany. And I mean, for sure there were certain ethnic tensions in the Middle East, but there wasn't anywhere close to the kind of anti-Semitism that existed in Europe at the time. So why was there this zero-sum game? It's either them or us.
I think that it's a too big of a cultural gap between them, the Europeans, and the Levant.
Okay.
Don't forget that all the first immigration waves to Israel, almost all, not all, but almost all, were from East Europe.
Yeah.
Places without any tradition of democracy. Russia, Poland, no democracy in their understanding. They were not democratic states ever. And they came here and they wanted to have East Europe here.
Right.
They didn't want an Arab state here or a Mediterranean state or a Middle Eastern state. They wanted a European state here, a European society here. Took something so basic. If an immigrant comes to your country, he's supposed to, first of all, learn the language of the country. Almost all of the head of Zionism never learned Arabic.
Yeah.
Never bothered to do so. This shows you everything, I think.
So do you think they saw themselves as colonizers, as settlers?
They wouldn't agree to it, to this definition, but they behaved like colonizers, no doubt. They behaved like such, yes.
Yeah. Well, I guess the question is then, if you're not an immigrant and you're not a colonizer, then what are you? I mean, how did they see themselves?
Look, the right-wingers, the religious ones, they see themselves coming back to their home.
Hmm.
Not even, I mean, you can still hear in the right wing of Israel talking like it's not an occupation because the people cannot occupy its own land. Talking like the whole land belongs to us for 2,000 years. We came home. This was the idea of Zionism. We came home.
Yeah.
And if you come home, you don't have to adjust to the neighbors because it's your home. This by far was the perception of all the Zionists.
Do you consider the Nakba to be Israel's original sin? Do you feel that way as an Israeli?
Totally. Totally. Without any doubts. I'll say more than this. I think that even establishing a state here could have been done in a different way.
Yeah.
Because I can't say that the Jews shouldn't have come here because really they didn't have where to go, most of them. Again, I'm getting to my father. Some of his friends and relatives found rescue in South Africa, in Australia, in Canada, in the United States, but not everyone could get it. And he had nowhere to go. But for sure, that's the sin. And the problem is not only the sin, the problem is that Israel never recognized the sin, never was ready to take accountability about the sin, not to speak about compensation about the sin, not to speak about some corrections, like letting some of them return. This they could have done in the first years easily.
Yeah.
Let some of them get back. But no, we shot them. In the 50s, we shot anyone who tried to get back to his village or house. We just shot them.
Do you think that if Jews living in Eastern Europe or Jews living under the Third Reich had been given the choice or the ability to, or had been accepted in other and Western countries, that they would have chosen to go there instead of going to Palestine? Because there were put in place immigration restrictions in the late 30s. And despite the fact that there was this conference in France in 1938 to try to address the problem, which it then was considered, of Jews living in Germany and Austria, and not one single country agreed to accept one single Jewish refugee. If things had played out differently, do you think that many more European Jews would have gone to a Western country that was familiar to them instead of going to Palestine?
So first of all, part of them did so. There was a core of Jews who already believed in the 30s in the Zionistic idea. And they for sure would prefer Palestine. I mean, the first waves of immigration were very Zionistic because they came out of choice. They didn't have to leave Europe until the early 30s. Those who came before, for sure. I mean, Ben-Gurion came in the beginning of the century.
Yeah.
Came with a Zionist conviction much before everything started. So there were many ideological immigrants who came here in order to put some foundations for a Jewish state here, no doubt. I'll give you an example. When the Russians, the Soviet Russia, opened its gates to the Jews, Israel insisted that all the Jews who leave Russia land first in Israel, because they knew that some of them, most of them, would rather go to the United States and wanted to make it harder for them. But it was really a fight that they will land first of all here, which means that they knew that many, many, many of them would, I don't know if the majority, maybe the majority of the Russian Jewry in the 70s would have gone to the United States, and some of them obviously went. So same about those years. I can tell you definitely my father wouldn't have come here. That's for sure. But Ben-Gurion would have come here because he was a Zionist.
Yeah.
A very convinced one.
Israel often adopts the position that it never intended to go to war with Gaza or Lebanon or Egypt or any of the countries it has attacked and, of course, been attacked by in the past 75 years. It maintains that it's a country that defends itself. When it comes to the Nakba, Israel had already expelled 250,000 Palestinians before any Arab army declared war on it in May of 1948. How does Israel justify this, or the main narrative?
The main narrative that we were told was very simple. They attacked us, and then they either ran away, mainly they ran away. And part of them were incited by the Arab leaders to leave. This is what we were told.
Yeah.
We didn't expel anyone. They ran away, and they attacked us. And we were the weak ones. We were the David and they were the Goliath.
Yeah.
We were the few one. We were without arms. They had all the arms. All kind of propaganda lies. None of them has connection to reality. And this is what we were told. And therefore, there was no question at all. Why did we expel them? Because according to the Israeli narrative, we didn't expel anyone.
Yeah, they left of their own accord.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then you have to ask, okay, they left. Why don't you let them back? In the first Gulf War, I had a baby of half a year old at home. We left home and we went to Eilat. We ran away to Eilat in the south part of Israel, far away from the danger. And after the war was over, we got into our car and went back to our home. Nobody had thought that if we left our home in a war, we don't have the right to come back.
Yeah.
But Israel had the different laws.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's one of the main really shocking aspects of that, of the Nakba, that many, many people couldn't even conceive of not being able to come home again.
In my view, it's worse than the expel.
Yeah.
Because let's say it was a war and I don't know what. But the fact they couldn't come back, this shows that it was with a very bad intention.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
That's very, very important, this point. Because if it's just a war, so let them come back after the war.
You mentioned, well, obviously, we're talking about the Holocaust because it's so central to our conversation. And you mentioned your father barely escaping it and his entire family being wiped out in it. It's obviously a sensitive subject, but it's also something that's used and manipulated by certain people in order to not be able to criticize Israel at all. And you called the Nakba a small Holocaust or a little Holocaust in one of your columns. How do you feel when people accuse those who at this point dare to use the Holocaust as a comparative example when they call that rhetoric anti-Semitic? How do you respond to that?
Look, that's the most efficient Israeli propaganda. And they studied it quite late, only in the last 10 years or so, labeling anyone who is daring to criticize Israel as an anti-Semite. It's very hard to criticize Israel because immediately you are labeled as an anti-Semite. And who wants in Europe to be labeled as an anti-Semite? And same in many other countries. It became almost criminal to criticize Israel. It's unbelievable. Not to speak about putting sanctions over Israel or calling to boycott Israel is perceived as anti-Semitism. While it's not only legitimate, it's appreciated to boycott Russia, to boycott all kind of evil regimes in the world, to boycott the meat industry, to boycott the sweatshops in Southeast Asia. That's really signs of good citizenship, of values, of consciousness. But when it comes to calling to boycott Israel, it is illegitimate and many times even illegal in certain countries.
Yeah.
So this manipulation of Israel using the Holocaust for its own political goals really annoys me a lot, because I see how Europeans are scared to raise their voices.
Yeah. When one reads about how the Zionist militias in 1947 and 1948, they were actively searching for a pretext to go to war with Palestinians and kick them off their land. And it was quite difficult to find in many cases because rural Palestinians in particular just kind of went on with their lives hoping that this crisis would go away. But one pretext or justification that was given was to give the green light to attack and in many cases kill any Palestinian that had taken part in the 1936 revolt, which was mainly aimed at the British, but also against Zionism. And when you look into the casualty figures of that revolt, I think 260-something British officers were killed, 500 Jews were killed, and 5,000 Palestinians were killed. Using this as a pretext for the ethnic cleansing in many cases of Palestine, it's hard for me to make sense of it. Can you explain that?
Can you explain that almost 30,000 Palestinians were killed in Gaza because 1,200 Jews were killed? It's unbelievable how those analogies are precise and nothing changed. 1,200 Israelis were slaughtered in a brutal way on the 7th of October, 2023. Does this justify killing of 30,000 Palestinians, 11,000 children? Same.
Yeah.
And therefore it is so terrible because nothing changed ever since then. Israel will always give itself a green light to commit any crimes based on some atrocities that were done against Jews or Israelis. Nothing changed.
Israel claims to be a multi-ethnic and a multicultural country with Jews from Europe and Africa and Asia, but the early Zionists were dominated by European Ashkenazi Jews. And these are the same people that we've been talking about who went on to perpetrate the Nakba. Who were these Zionists? And obviously, it was different kinds of people. I mean, obviously, you had ultra-Orthodox Jews that came strictly for religious reasons, and you had nationalists that came with a clear intent on creating a state. And I mean, who were these people, and what were they motivated by?
So you said it by yourselves, everything and everything. First of all, obviously, as you say, not only Europeans, but East Europeans.
Yeah.
Because the German Jews who came only in the 30s were quite isolated, or isolated themselves, but also were also pushed to the corner. They came here, you see, Albert Einstein never thought to come here.
Yeah.
Live here, to immigrate here. The majority were East European Jews, mainly, as I said, Russia and Poland. And as I said, they came with very little understanding of democracy, and they came with a conviction to build here a country in any price, to create a state here, a Jewish state, not a binational state, a Jewish state in any price. Most of them were socialists, part even communists, but most of them were socialists. And they tried to implement this socialism here, but only on the Jews. This is also a very weird way of socialism. When you put it only, they never cared about the rights of the Palestinian workers when you speak about socialism, Never. It was only about the Jews. And they created some wonderful, they implemented some wonderful ideas. The kibbutz, the cooperation, the moshav. But finally, at least the founders had a very Zionistic conviction. The founders.
Yeah.
The Orthodox who came here didn't take part of the building of a country or a state. They were isolated in their own communities, and most of them didn't take part. And later on in the 50s started to come the Jews from the Arab states, which are discriminated until this very moment.
Yeah.
They were discriminated from first moment.
You've written that in order for Israel to become the truly pluralistic democracy that it claims to be, it must first acknowledge the crimes it committed in 1948 and commemorate the victims of the Nakba on its Independence Day. Do you think that this would lead, or at least be a step towards some kind of meaningful peace with Palestinians?
Already 20, 30 years ago, I wrote once, and excuse me for quoting myself, we all remember Willy Brandt in his first visit in Israel as a chancellor, went to Yad Vashem, sat on his knees and asked for forgiveness. It touched many hearts in Israel, many, many hearts in Israel. I remember it was in the 70s.
Yeah.
I always thought that an Israeli prime minister who would go to the parliament in Ramallah or in Gaza and ask for forgiveness from the Palestinians can be a first and meaningful step toward creating a new reality. Today, those things sound really lunatic. I wouldn't have even written them today.
No.
I think they would have sent me a psychiatrist if I would have write it. But 20, 30 years ago, in the years of Oslo, there was still this innocent naiveness that maybe we are going to a new reality. And then I really thought that this can be a very, not only meaningful, but essential step, not only in talkings, also in actions, in taking measures.
Yeah.
Letting some to return, compensating. Things should have been done, sure. And then we would have been in a different place today.
Yeah. And at the time, I assume that you were in favor of a two-state solution. But since then, you've changed your views according to realities on the ground. And now you support a one-state solution. What does that look like to you? What kind of state is that?
First of all, the two-state solution is a better solution. It's easier to implement. two peoples are struggling over one piece of land, let's divide the land. And also there is a question of self-determination. The Jews want a Jewish state, the Palestinians have the right for a Palestinian state. Deal done. The only problem is that we have now 3 or 4 times more settlers than in the years of Oslo. They tripled or maybe even more. We have 700,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Nobody is going to evacuate them because they are the strongest political group in Israel, the strongest and the most violent one.
Yeah.
If no one is going to evacuate them, there is no room for a Palestinian state, for sure not for a viable state. And then you have to ask yourself, okay, if not this, what else can it be? The one state exists now 55 years, 56 years. Me and a journalist in Gaza and the journalist in Jenin, we are all under the same government.
Yeah.
So right now it's maybe far-fetched, but by the end of the day, as simple as that, equal rights between the river and the Mediterranean, between the river and the sea, equal rights to everyone who lives there. Yeah. Like any Swede has equal rights with other Swedes, any Israeli or Palestinian who lives in Israel-Palestine should have the same rights. But right now, nobody is listening.
Do you think in order to achieve that, that Israel would have to give up its identity as a Jewish state?
No other way. With all the respect, you cannot have it all.
Yeah.
If you want a Jewish state, which I don't couldn't care less, it's either Jewish or democratic right now. It cannot be both. If you are Jewish, you are not democratic. If you are democratic, you are not Jewish. Because we are 7.5 million Palestinians and 7.5 million Jews between the river and the sea.
Yeah.
And it cannot be Jewish and not giving equal rights to the Palestinians. It can be either Jewish or democratic.
Yeah. When it comes to Israeli media today, you've said that it's free media insofar as media is free in the Western capitalist world. And yet, collectively, with the exception of Haaretz, it serves as, and this is what you've written, it serves as a propaganda machine for the Israeli state. Why is that?
First of all, from the establishment of the state, the media played a role as a one branch of the propaganda machinery of Israel from day one. But I could understand it in the first years of Israel when it was really very fragile and there was no tradition of democracy, as I told you. So I could have understood it there. What happened in this war now in Gaza is the most shameful time of Israeli media ever, because it does it voluntarily, because there is no pressure from the government or the army or the secret services, because it is relatively free, because there is almost no censorship, because all this, the media recruited itself voluntarily to be part of Israel's propaganda, to hide parts of reality, to ignore, to deny, and to serve as a branch of the army spokesperson in the war.
Yeah.
This is the most shameful hour of Israeli media ever.
Gideon Levy, thank you so much for being with us today on the Kalam podcast.
Thank you so much, Edgar. I enjoyed every minute.
So did I. Thanks.
Every minute of your clever questions, your knowledge, and it was also challenging for me.
Yeah, thank you so much, Gideon. I really, really appreciate that. That was the renowned Israeli journalist and political dissident, Gideon Levy, and the second part of the Kalam podcast two-part series on the Nakba. I hope you enjoyed it. For more of Gideon's writing, check out his weekly column in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Next week, we're going to look at the 1967 war, the rise and fall of Arab nationalism, the birth of the PLO and the Palestinian guerrilla resistance, and the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And I'm so excited to have the one and only Professor Khaled Fehmi on the show. He's a renowned Egyptian historian and has written extensively on the 1967 war. Until then, that's all from the Kalam podcast. Kalam is written and hosted by me, Edgar Mannheimer. Research and production is by Sam Karlshamre, and sound design is by Arthur Mannheimer.